On this episode of Women Behind Bars, one woman pled guilty to the murder of her husband.
He said, bitch, you don't even know how to use it. I said, we're going to see. And I took the safety off, I pumped it, and I shot him.
She continued to try to make it melt, make it burn.
I didn't know what to do, and I just kept trying to cover it up, cover it up, cover it up.
Then, Anita Gonzalez was convicted of murdering and robbing an elderly friend.
Our officers found the victim, Edward Riesdorf, lying in the garage. He had received severe blunt trauma to his head and face.
She's the devil in disguise.
Two women, two brutal crimes. These are the stories of Lutrice Dancy and Anita Gonzalez. On October 6, 2003, Miami-Dade police officers were called to a local home where neighbors reported a horrific odor coming from the residence.
When I got here, the smell was just incredible. Throughout the years of experience, it was a familiar odor, that of a decomposed body.
Inside the home, detectives made a grisly discovery, the corpse of 51-year-old Walter Dancy. Investigators determined the body had been shot, doused with acid, and set on fire.
I haven't seen a corpse violated that way. I don't think ever.
Police arrested the victim's wife of 2 years, Lutrice Dancy.
The aftermath of the murder is what really is totally out of the ordinary because of the extent that she went to try to dispose of the body. She continued to try to make it melt, make it burn, try to do so many things to it.
I'm just scared. I didn't know what to do. And I just kept trying to cover it up, cover it up, cover it up. I wouldn't say I was sane because a sane person really wouldn't do what I did. I'm just angry and did everything spontaneously, and I just did it.
Was Lutrice Dancy insane when she murdered her husband and ravaged his body? Or was she a ruthless killer covering up a calculated crime? Lutrice Dancy grew up in the working-class neighborhood of Little Haiti, a few miles from the glistening Miami skyline and world-class beaches.
I was number 5 out of 9. Mom and dad together. We was poor. Well, my dad made ends meet. Mom take care of the kids, take care of home.
Life for the 9 Cooper kids revolved around attending church, school, and minding their parents. Lutrice had other ideas.
She was lovable, very, and tremendous wild. Trish was a special breed. She just rebelled.
I was a rebellious child because if I get punished, if I get a beating, it didn't matter to me. I'm gonna do it and receive the consequences later.
Her stubborn determination both haunted and helped Lutrice throughout the rest of her life. At age 11, her childhood almost ended when Lutrice contracted a rare blood disorder. The illness paralyzed her entire body.
Guillain-Barré. It's a blood disease that collapsed the muscles in my body.
A lot of people thought she wouldn't recover, but she did.
I had to learn to talk, walk, and do all that over again. It was kind of scary, but you know, I survived it.
Lutrice overcame her bout with death, only to face yet another challenge.
I was having sex. I started at the age of 12. I was 13 when I had the child, but he didn't live. I guess that was like a blessing. I was too young.
To escape the trauma of her illness and losing her baby, Lutrice tried to find a positive outlet for her pain.
I played sports in school. I did everything. Sung in the choir, honors choir.
She was on a track team. She played softball. She played soccer. You name it, Trish did it.
Very talented in sport. She played softball. She played basketball. And she was good at it.
But sports weren't enough to keep her attention. She started hanging out with an older crowd and experimenting with pot and cocaine. The addiction would chase her for the rest of her life.
I hung out with the older girls and they'd use it, and older men, they had the drugs. I just wanted to fit in with the crowd. And then I started enjoying it.
It's like she was withdrawing. Like, something just took her life away.
The fragile 18-year-old no longer wanted to live and attempted suicide by taking pills.
My brother-in-law have all kind of barbiturates, and he gave me some because I don't want to live no more.
His effect is very bad, very bad.
Latrice survived the suicide attempt, but there would be others. In 1988, with her life back on track, she met a Rastafarian named David. The couple married, and Latrice soon became pregnant.
I got pregnant again while I was about to get high.
She continued using, and 7 months later, Latrice gave birth to a premature baby girl named Awiya. The infant weighed only 1 pound, 3 ounces.
The social worker came to see me, and she said, so much drugs are found in your child's system. The doctors didn't even know what some of it was. And she said, what are you going to do? I say, I'm going to treatment.
She went on to have 2 more kids, but like so many addicts, she relapsed again and again. Finally, faced with losing her children, she moved into the Village, an inpatient rehab center where drug-addicted mothers lived with their kids.
I don't want to leave nobody responsible to take care of my children but me. And it's time for me to be a mom. Because me using drugs is not going to help them.
13 months later, Latrice emerged sober and determined to lead a positive life.
Everybody in the stadium wanted the best. Any school function, a Christmas play, a talent show, she'll be there.
I volunteered at the school the whole year. I got parents of the year that year because I was just like, I'm going to work.
She was always at my school.
Latrice continued to thrive working in outreach and caring for her 3 kids. In 1996, she and her husband David divorced because she says his use of marijuana threatened her recovery. 2 years later, she met 46-year-old Walter Dancy.
He was a hardworking man and provided for the household and did what he could for his children.
He had children and he had siblings who he was very close to. They often got together as a family. Latrice was part of that as well.
He's very supportive. The whole while we dating, very respectful, you know. He was all lovey-dovey.
Walter went to work every day. He, based on what we learned during the course of the investigation, he also hung out a lot with his male friends, drinking.
Point blank, he was a whore. He was a whore when I met him, he was a whore when I dated him.
It depends on who you ask to describe their relationship. Latrice described him as domineering, sort of like, I'm the man, I do what I want, except where I've been. Walter's family described Latrice as being domineering in terms of no matter what he did, it never pleased her.
The couple married in 2000 because Latrice says she was pregnant. After getting an abortion, Latrice claims Walter became violent.
There were no police reports that we could find about it. There were no anecdotal reports by her to other people with regard to the domestic violence.
That doesn't mean it doesn't happen. And it happens all the time. Oftentimes you see the women are the victims and they have been abused and there's not a single iota of documentation anywhere. It's unfortunate.
According to Latrice, there was a reason no police reports were ever filed.
They don't have no reports because guess what? Every time they come to the house, he go talk to them. And anytime I call, I end up in the hospital.
When Women Behind Bars continues.
She grabbed a shotgun and she pointed it at him.
And he said, bitch, you don't even know how to use it. I said, we're going to see. And I took the safety off, I pumped it, and I shot him.
After years of battling depression and a severe addiction to crack cocaine, Latrice Dancy finally got sober and was even voted Parent of the Year at her kid's school. In 1998, the 36-year-old met self-employed Walter Dancy. The couple married and moved in together in a Miami suburb with Latrice's 3 children. But she claims the problems began as soon as she said, I do.
He hit my mom and they got into a big altercation. And some nights we'll just leave for like a couple of days, then come back.
I began to start hating him for the beatings. And this man really playing games and I'm the laughing stock.
After 2 years of marriage, Latrice says she felt totally humiliated and began to unravel.
I couldn't believe, out of all the men I dated, and this is the way I get treated.
You have mental health issues and you have substance abuse issues. It can be a very violent combination.
After several more hospitalizations and alleged suicide attempts, Latrice was at her wit's end. She and her marriage were in crisis.
Her and Walter hadn't been getting along. Walter came home slightly intoxicated and went to sleep. Latrice went outside to the car to see if he had left any money.
Instead of finding the money in his glove compartment, what she found were some incriminating photographs of Mr. Dancy, supposedly with some other women.
Graphic photos depicting sexual acts, and that sort of set her off.
Tears start coming up. I'm just like, I don't believe this. He bring this crap all over here. Now I got a husband that's sitting here with people sitting there smoking stuff, sick people, and I'm having unprotected sex with you.
According to Latrice, she'd been wronged for the last time.
This was, at least in her mind, the ultimate humiliation. She comes inside, and of course there were a variety of weapons in the house, baseball bats, handguns, and there was a shotgun.
She grabbed a shotgun, and she pointed it at him, and in his shooing her off and making light of the situation again, he called her a stupid bitch.
And he said, bitch, you don't even know how to use it. I said, we're going to see. And I took the safety off, I pumped it, and I shot him. And he just looked at me and dropped. I guess because of the alcohol in his system, no blood went anywhere, nobody heard anything.
I was in my room, really getting like, I didn't hear nothing at all.
Walter lay dead on the floor from a shotgun wound to the chest. What happened next would shock even the most hardened homicide detectives.
That night, I bagged them up and I put them in the closet because my kids like to come to my room.
Dancy told her kids that Walter had left and sent them to school. Paralyzed with fear, Latrice played solitaire at home all day while she tried to come up with a plan.
I cried, I hurt. I love my husband. Even though he beat me, I didn't want it to happen like that. I just wanted him to just go and just leave me alone.
Desperate to cover her tracks, the 41-year-old mother of three decided she had to get rid of the body. But first, she reported Walter missing.
Not only did she call the police, but she called the victim's family, who came over. So while she had this poor man in the closet wrapped up in garbage bags, she had his kids, his older children, and telling them how he was missing.
To be able to sit down with your husband's family and file a false police report, that's pretty bad.
She probably had rationalized it to, she makes a police report, then everyone perceives him as being missing. So if he never turns up again, then he's missing. It's not that she killed him.
After 3 days in the closet, Walter's body was in full decomposition and gave off a foul stench. She sent her kids to stay with a friend and put in motion her plan to dispose of the body.
She comes up with a secondary plan of putting him in the bathtub and going to buy some acid, pour it on the body, and hopefully the acid's gonna dissolve the body and she'll get rid of it that way.
Latrice went to a hardware store and purchased 2 gallons of muriatic acid, gloves, and a rake. Some miniature Halloween pumpkins also caught her eye.
I'm a holiday festive person. And I saw those pumpkins. I gotta get one from my mom's house.
She was also concerned about the fact that someone would be suspicious of her buying these pool chemicals. That would kind of mislead them, to assure that.
Once home, Latrice dragged Walter's swollen corpse to the bathtub. She doused him with 2 gallons of acid, hoping to melt him.
I wasn't thinking. Maybe like I put the acid on, it'll
shrivel up and get his bones and just deteriorate it. Nothing happened, but he just like bubbled up. And I'm just like, oh, no.
He was still there and now he's smelled even worse. So at that point, she decides to light him on fire.
So she bought lighter fluid and she poured lighter fluid on him, hoping to burn away the stench.
But Lutrice had to do something to deal with the smoke.
I put the grill on the outside of my bathroom door, putting hamburgers out on the grill so it could be smoking out there, so I could see the smoke out of the bathroom. They want to know about it, just cooking some hamburgers out there because I always like to cook out.
While she was barbecuing the meat, it was to cover the smell of the burning Walter.
Like the acid, lighting Walter on fire did not work. His ravaged body was still there.
I was just trying to eliminate it. Just let it dissolve, just disintegrate, just go away. I just wanted a whole day, night to go away. Like it never existed, just he's not there.
Now Latrice is at a point where she's tried this and it's not working. So she's got to go to the next step. She's got to get the body out of the house.
The smell started getting, then I went to Home Depot and I got some freshener and down to Family Dollar. Family Dollar got paid a lot of money off of me trying to keep that smell down.
Despite Lutrecia's efforts to mask the smell, the stench spilled into the street. Several neighbors called the police to report the suspicious odor.
I told my neighbor that my sewer had backed up. She met the police and said, well, no, what do you mean dead body? She said, oh, sewer backed up.
The police could not find the source of the smell and believed the neighbor and left.
Human bodies start to putrefy, particularly if they're not in cold storage, relatively soon after a person dies. Also swell, and she decided she's just got to get rid of Walter.
I was trying any and every way to do what I got to do by myself. I didn't want to tell nobody. I just wanted to get rid of his body. I'd take him too long. I just got to get the body out of here.
As a last resort, Lutrice decided to take Walter's body to the Everglades and dump it. But first, she had to get his corpse out of the house and into her Chevy.
She finally got so exasperated that she went to a neighbor and said, listen, I need to wheel out my husband's body.
When Women Behind Bars continues.
When I actually went inside, it was just a combination of things that this victim had gone through. I had never seen anything like that before.
I felt bad because here it is. He has three children that I took their father, and it started hurting real bad.
And later.
One thing I've learned about this job is evil exists. I've seen it. This woman is evil. Evil people need to be removed from society.
On October 1st, 2003, Lutrice Dancy, after suffering years of alleged infidelity and abuse, shot and killed her husband, Walter Dancy, known in the neighborhood as Wa Lewis. The 41-year-old mother of three then attempted to cover up the murder by dissolving his corpse in acid and burning the body. When neither worked, Lutrice planned to dump Dancy in the Everglades. Desperate, she asked a neighbor to borrow a dolly to move her dead husband.
The neighbor goes back inside and he's like, wait a minute, did she just say she was gonna move her husband's body? And at that point, he called the police.
In her panic, Lutrice locked herself out of the home. As reality set in, she then called the one man who was always there for her.
I called my dad and I said, Daddy, I killed Wa Lewis. He said, baby, don't go nowhere. I'm coming over. So now this time I'm losing it.
Joe Cooper met the police and told them what happened. Homicide detective Rolando Garcia was one of the first on the scene.
It was a hot day, normal routine call. Once I get out of the car, I felt and I sensed and smelled that decomposition. When I actually went inside, it was just a combination of things that this victim had gone through. I had never seen anything like that before.
The six-day ordeal was over, and Latrice finally broke down.
Her demeanor was totally distraught. I mean, whatever she wanted to do, she knew she wasn't going to get away with it. She was pretty hysterical.
Police arrested Latrice and took her to the Miami Police Department, where she was interrogated by Sergeant Eunice Cooper.
Well, let me ask you this. Why did you decide to burn him with the acid? Is it because he was smelling?
I just figured he can just burn it. It'd be easy for me to put him in little bags. Put him in bags. And I'm just like, it's not doing anything anyway. It's just making sizzling sounds and stuff going outside of the window.
Mm-hmm. Well, did it have a smoke, a cloud?
Yeah, you know.
Yeah.
It was negative.
I think her willingness to talk about it and the Rambo acts that she took to kill him, I think it all came very easily. And it was not like, I'm sorry I did it. It was not like, I wish I hadn't done it. It was more like, I had to do it. And these are the things that I did to get it done.
I'm caught red-handed and I did it. So what's the high now?
Police charged Latrice with first-degree murder. With a full confession, gruesome crime scene photos, and stacks of incriminating evidence, the defense faced a near-impossible legal battle.
I had filed a notice of reliance on an insanity defense, and I had her evaluated by an eminent neuropsychiatrist. She had major depression. She had confused thinking. She had an ability to control anger behavior. But he couldn't diagnose her as being schizophrenic or psychotic.
The defense attorney did a lot of work with regard to her mental state. I think he believed the only way to defend this case would have been a mental health defense, but it just wasn't there based on her actions.
She demonstrated rationality by lying, hiding the body, moving her children, buying pool acid, trying to get rid of the smell. Now, these were all obviously sick behavior and impractical. But once again, it didn't arise to the level of what would be considered insanity under the law of the state of Florida.
2 years later, in 2005, the case went to trial. If found guilty, Latrice would be sentenced to life without parole.
My opinion to Latrice was that if you go to trial, regardless of what jurors we pick, doesn't matter, and they play your tape, and as soon as they look at the pictures, they're going to convict you. Because if you say you did it, explain how you did it, and they see what you did, they'll have no alternative but to convict you.
At the last second, Latrice accepted a plea, guilty of second-degree murder with a sentence of 45 years.
With her age and everything, that would be a long enough sentence that she's not getting out of jail.
I know I'm guilty, so there's no way I'm gonna be found not guilty. 45 years to me is less than life. No possibly a parole. I'll be able to walk out of here.
If you commit a crime like that, there's got to be a reason. And this really would upset me so bad. I mean, she sat in jail 2 years and then took a plea bargain. To me, it wasn't no plea bargain.
What she did to Mr. Dancy was horrendous and cruel. 45 years is the exact price that fits the crime. I don't see any reason why she should get out before then.
In 2005, Latrice was transferred to a maximum security prison near Miami, Florida. She has adapted well to the structured life behind bars.
To have somebody tell you to sit down, do this, do that, do this. I can follow orders. I'm very cooperative. You get 3 meals a day, you get a cart, all you gotta do is clean, cook, whatever you gotta do. Just do it and you're back into, just like you're back home.
Latrice is now sober and faithfully takes her medication. Although she is in touch with her kids through letters, it pains her to be away from them.
I'm sorry, I left you. Sorry, I put you down. I'm sorry. I truly haven't accepted that part, that I left my kids out there. They're my main concern. You know, I left them.
I just wish that she could come home and be here with us. Everybody love her and we miss her dearly.
Latrice still thinks about how she could have handled the situation differently with her husband.
No one deserved to die because they cheat. He beat me. I just got angry and I just got tired of it.
In Latrice Dancy's case, her efforts to save herself from her perceived humiliation caused a lot of pain for her children, for her family, for Walter's family. And ultimately, it ended up with her being incarcerated and away from the very people whom she was trying to save face with.
I have a lot of regrets. I could have just went ahead, packed up, and just gone and started over somewhere else and left him. He'll be alive, and I'll be with my children.
Next up on Women Behind Bars, a robbery turns fatal.
You can't say that you're totally innocent and then go to a bank with the check from a dead man.
For more information about Women Behind Bars, go to WeTV.com. On January 26, 1996, a teller at a check cashing business became suspicious when 37-year-old Anita Gonzalez tried to cash an $11,000 check allegedly signed by Edward Riesdorf.
The girl at National Check Cashing calls back to the Riesdorf home.
A young male answers the phone and starts talking to the check cashing company representative.
This is supposed to be an elderly man, so she got suspicious. She refused to cash the check.
Police raced to the home, but they were too late. 68-year-old Edward Riesdorf lay dead in a pool of blood.
He had received severe blunt trauma to his head and face.
Authorities arrested 18-year-old David Shane Tate, his mother Anita Gonzalez, and two acquaintances. But police believe that it was Anita who planned the robbery and murder.
One thing I've learned about this job is evil exists. I've seen it. This woman is evil. And evil people need to be removed from society.
Was Anita Gonzalez a calculating, greedy woman who orchestrated her close friend's death? Or was she a victim manipulated by a gang of hoodlums?
Anita is a lot of fun. She always felt inferior to her older sister, but she had a good childhood.
The Stapletons raised their kids on the coast of northern Florida near the world-famous Kennedy Space Center. But from an early age, Anita tested her parents and defied their rules.
She would get upset about things, and she'd take off and be gone for several days.
In high school, Anita enjoyed cheerleading, but earned only average grades and dropped out before graduating. At age 17, she got pregnant and married the father.
It was a bad time because the one that she married was, plain speaking, a no-good skunk. He was abusive.
In 1977, Anita gave birth to a son named David Shane Tate, whom she called Shane. According to Anita, the next 3 years were a life of hell due to the daily beatings from her husband. The couple divorced in 1980. Soon after, Anita claims she cut her hand in a tomato slicer while working in a restaurant. As a result, she was in and out of the hospital some 40 times.
She was on workers' comp. So a lot of her identity was being sick. I don't remember exactly when she started having them, but she's always had health problems.
But Anita's insurance company questioned the validity of her claims. She was sent to a psychiatric hospital for a 3-week evaluation.
They determined that a part of it was a mental issue, but it was also a physical.
Over the next 10 years, Anita alleges she underwent 12 more operations for another work-related injury. She admits that as a result, she became addicted to painkillers.
She was always taking medicine. She was becoming attached to them, and it did worry me.
I'm extremely skeptical about her medical claims. If they weren't self-induced, they were fabricated for purposes of acquiring drugs.
Anita's personal life was also in crisis. After two more failed marriages, the 32-year-old married husband number 4, Todd Wagner. Wagner had a 3.5-year-old son named Sean from a previous relationship.
A Thursday night in June, Todd called me and wanted me to bring my son Sean over, and I said, okay, fine. Friday morning, my child supposedly got into a bottle of Elavil and ate 30 tablets.
Sean was rushed to the hospital, but the pills used to treat Anita's depression were too much for his little body. Police investigated Anita for neglect and allegedly prohibited her from being around children or the elderly. Robin Alderman believes Anita played a more serious role in Sean's death.
It is impossible that my son took 30 pills. She's the devil in disguise.
Anita denied any wrongdoing in Sean's death, but there would be more brushes with the law.
She was essentially a little Ma Barker. She'd previously been charged and pled with burglary and theft. She'd been investigated for insurance fraud.
By the mid-1990s, Anita's 18-year-old son, David Shane Tate, was also racking up a criminal record and hanging out with a gang of kids known as the Merritt Island Posse.
Shane, he was doing a lot of residential burglaries, a lot of vehicle burglaries.
Merritt Island Posse is a group of about 100 kids that lived in my town. Oh, we just raised hell.
None of these kids had any real education. They were just having a grand old time, and they thought the party would last forever. And apparently it didn't.
While her son Shane ran wild, Anita says she was drowning in guilt because she felt she couldn't provide for him. She was so desperate for cash, she took out credit cards in her mother's name.
The credit cards that she had, I did not apply for. And I had to take the money out of my retirement and pay them off.
But authorities believe Anita found a new mark in 1994 when she met her ex-boyfriend's elderly parents, Teddy and Donna Riesdorf. Their son describes his parents' first encounters with Anita.
She said she had cancer, and my mom said, I think I've got cancer. And then Anita started coming over, and she befriended my parents.
They treated her as if she was their daughter, and she liked that relationship and liked having that feeling of being liked.
Dad worked for Southern Bell for about 35 years before he retired, and my mom sold real estate, but within the last 10, 15 years, she just kind of was a homemaker.
Over the next year, Anita ingratiated herself into the Riesdorf family.
They loved her very dearly, and she loved them.
Anita claims she oversaw Donna's medical care, and Teddy gave her Donna's credit card to help her with her finances. But authorities paint a different picture.
Ms. Riesdorf was still in the hospital. Anita acquired at least one of Donna Riesdorf's credit cards, which she had been using.
He might have helped her out on a couple things, like groceries, but he's not going to pay her bills. I guess Anita had found out about his finances, and then when the time was right, she stole that ATM card from my mom's purse while she's in the hospital and started racking it up.
We had numerous videotapes, receipts for weeks of Anita at ATMs at 2, 3, 4 o'clock in the morning, draining several hundred dollars at a time out of Mr. Riesdorf's checking account. And she was taking that money and she was having parties with her son and all her son's friends.
It was at one of these drug-fueled parties that police say Anita recruited her 18-year-old son and his friend Timon Black to steal blank checks from her beloved friends. 23-year-old Anisha Muncy, who met Anita a couple of weeks before the murder, also joined to help cash the forged checks.
Anita, myself, Timon, and David were going to go to the house. The two boys were going to go inside and see if he was home. If he was, they were going to tie him up and put him into the bathroom. Anita was going to go in and get the check, and we were going to go to the bank and cash it. And there was no talk of killing in front of me.
When Women Behind Bars continues.
He told him, please leave me alone. Shane didn't stop. He bludgeoned my father to death right here.
David Shane Tate actually did the murder, but his mother masterminded it.
In 1994, Anita Gonzalez met Edward and Donna Riesdorf, an elderly couple living in Melbourne, Florida. The three became close, but police believe the 37-year-old had an ulterior motive. Addicted to painkillers and deeply in debt, authorities assert Anita conspired to rob the Riesdorfs with her 18-year-old son and two acquaintances.
The plan was to go into Mr. Riesdorf's home, subdue him, tie him up, steal his checkbook. Anita would then write checks out, and Anisha Muncy would then go and cash these checks.
But prosecutors maintain that unbeknownst to Anisha and Timon, Anita and her son David Shane Tate planned to kill Mr. Riesdorf from the beginning.
All this activity that had been going on by Anita on the credit card, that statement was due. Mr. Riesdorf was going to be killed before he could find out about this.
On January 25th, 1996, at the break of dawn, Anita, her son, David Shane Tate, Timon Black, and Anisha Muncy drove to the Riesdorf residence. Anita knew that Donna Riesdorf was visiting her mother, leaving her husband Teddy in the house by himself.
The stress level went up when we dropped the two boys off and we went and parked at the end of the street.
5:36 in the morning. Dad was in his chair, reading the paper and drinking his coffee, and he heard some commotion in the garage, so he got up to go check on it, and he went out through the back to go out into the garage. The dad come around here to this door to see, because they got in through the side door. And that's when the confrontation started, and I guess they wrestled around.
Shane armed himself with the pipe wrench and then struck Mr. Riesdorf. Mr. Riesdorf fought with him.
He told him, please leave me alone, don't hit me anymore, I'll give you what you want, and Shane didn't stop. He bludgeoned my father to death right here.
While Shane allegedly attacked Mr. Riesdorf in the garage, Anita and Anisha pulled into the driveway. According to Anisha, she had no idea the plan included murder. Police say that when Anita walked up to the driveway, she discovered that Timon had fled. Anita went after him while Anisha entered into the garage.
So that left me and Shane there. When he stepped back in the garage, the man was already laying down, and he picked up a pipe wrench and hit him twice. I didn't stop it. At that point, I don't know if I would have saved him or not. But that's a question that I've had to deal with.
The group sped off, leaving the 68-year-old's lifeless body on the cold garage floor. The gang then dumped the wrench in a nearby river, in the clothes on a dirt road. Back at Anisha's house, Anita proposed returning to the Riesdorfs for a second shot at stealing the blank checks, but Anisha refused to go.
Anita went back in, she stole the check. Anita still wanted to cash the check, but I wouldn't agree to do it. At that point, it was too much.
According to police, Anita then took the boys on a spending spree with a credit card she had allegedly taken from Mrs. Riesdorf months before.
She took them all to the mall. Spent off credit cards, took him out to lunch. She had a very carefree attitude.
The next day, Anita forged ahead with the plan to cash one of the checks. The check was typed out to Anita for $11,000. Timon then forged Mr. Riesdorf's name.
She made Timon do the signature forgery on the checks as punishment for leaving Shane at the house during the crime.
She first went to her own bank, apparently, and they wouldn't cash it. And then she went to National Check Casting Register. They made a copy of her identification.
The girl down there cashing the check indicated that, well, I'm going to have to call on this one after approval. So they tried to call Mr. Riesdorf's house, where, of course, nobody answers because there's nobody alive there.
So Anita said, well, he's probably sleeping. I'll go over to Mr. Riesdorf's house and wake him up.
Supposedly, Timon broke into the house again and answered the phone and said, yes, this is a good check.
This is supposed to be an elderly man, yet the voice on the phone sounded like obviously a young man. So she got suspicious, she refused to cash the check, Anita left. This girl then called law enforcement.
Our officers made entry into the house and found Edward Riesdorf. He was lying in the garage, partially covered with a blanket. He had received severe blunt trauma to his head and face.
While officers processed the scene, a SWAT team stormed Anita's residence. Timon and Shane were found hiding in the attic and were taken into custody. Anisha was also brought in. Shane denied any involvement with the burglary or murder, but Timon and Anisha told a different story.
I didn't kill anybody. David Shane Tate actually did the murder. He committed the murder, but his mother masterminded it.
Detectives had yet to bring in their prime suspect. But in a surprising turn of events, Anita called the station first, inquiring about her friend's death. She volunteered to come in and speak with Detective Casey.
She was very sad that he had died. Towards the end of the interview, when we explained that we had already spoken with Anisha, the co-defendant, and that the co-defendant had explained her involvement in it, then she tried to blame it on Anisha, but never made any admissions to being involved.
Anita and Shane were charged with first-degree murder and armed robbery. In January 1999, Anita's trial began but was declared a mistrial due to Anita's medical problems. A second trial commenced 3 months later. The prosecution had surmised that although Anita did not commit the murder, she was the instigator.
She set all the pieces in place, and then she shoved them out the door and said, go forth and do this. The best analogy would be Charlie Manson.
I don't think Anita could be a ringleader. She may have been a needy person, but I don't think she was ever a ringleader of any type.
The defense maintained that Anita had nothing to do with the murder or burglary and put the blame back on Anisha and Timon.
My defense was she was around these people, she was influenced by these people, but the act that they committed was on their own.
Teddy was one of her best friends, and so was Donna. I knew she didn't kill him, and I still to this day know that.
Although the murder weapon was never found, the prosecution presented a key piece of evidence.
The smoking gun was that check.
You can't say that you're totally innocent and then go to a bank with the check from a dead man.
She first said that this check was given to her previously. The problem is that check did not fit the numbers.
After 3 weeks of testimony, the jury returned with the verdict.
People were very passionate about Anita Gonzalez, either on her side or wanting to see her rot in hell.
The state of Florida is about 200 years behind times. There was no evidence that convicted them. There was lies and suppositions.
All of us that were sitting in my area supporting my father, we all hooted and hollered. Yep. It's probably better that they didn't get the electric chair because now they gotta wake up every day in prison thinking about what they did.
Anita has since admitted that she was involved in the burglary, but still maintains she had nothing to do with the murder. In 2008, while in prison, Anita says doctors found a lump in her chest.
The growth that she has on her chest is in some way connected to her lungs. We don't face a very rosy future at this point. As long as she's around, I'll be with her.
Teddy Riesdorf's wife, Donna, passed away from cancer 6 weeks after her husband was murdered. For Randy Riesdorf, there has been one positive change as a result of his father's death. While at the trial, he met and fell in love with Robin Alderman, the mother of the little boy who died taking Anita's medication.
She had lost a son years ago, and this woman, Anita, was behind it in one way or another, and we had a lot in common.
His dad was murdered by the same person, and it's a bond that's unbreakable. Somehow we've made it work for 10 years.
Still, Randy believes he can never let go of what happened to his father.
This is her last stunt. I can't forgive Shane or Anita. I probably never will get over that.